At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Luke Guerrero stands ready to take your finance and investment questions and share his unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. My name is Luke Guerrero, and it is Wednesday, August 14th, 2024, which means we're halfway through the week, we're almost halfway through the month, and almost halfway through the third quarter of 2024. What an exciting quarter it's been. What an exciting month it's been. You certainly cannot say that what is going on in the world is boring. And all of these things tend to have an effect on how the assets we hold within our portfolios perform. We need to pay attention to what's going on in the macro environment, what's going on in the country, what's going on globally, because we are in a global world, to help inform our investment decisions. And so we hope that each day we shine a little light, provide a little bit of insight, and help you become a better and more informed investor. With that being said, we'll run down today's market activity, today's CPI report, plenty of show topics that we have for you, and hopefully many, many questions. In fact, let's tackle one right now.
I was interested in buying some Greenbrier company. Symbol is GBX, and I would like to get one of your opinions on it. Thank you very much.
Greenbrier Company, ticker GBX, is a $1.4 million railroad freight car equipment company. It has $1.6 billion in debt, so a decent amount of debt, considering how big the company is. And more importantly, its interest coverage ratio, 1.8. Meaning that there's not much wiggle room, it's tough to say, not much wiggle room between the money it's making and how much money it has to pay off the interest on its debt. Usually red flag number one. Now, its cash flow has been pretty stagnant if you pull back on a five-year time horizon. It dipped down into 2022, then back up last year, and it's been pretty stationary. If you look at the revenue growth, it was about $3 billion in 2022, about $3 billion in 2020, $3 billion in 2019, almost $4 billion last year, projected to fall back down to $3.5 billion this year. Now, if you look at their chart, it looks like they dropped off a little bit after a steep climb in the middle of summer, dropped off at the beginning of the month. They've been ranging around 45. And at the same time, they're trading at about price to cash flow of 7. Price to book of 1.1, price to earnings of 10. So not crazy expensive, really not expensive at all whatsoever, in my opinion, in terms of a objective look at what valuation multiples mean. Now, just because those are normal valuation multiples doesn't mean that this company is fairly valued or overvalued or undervalued. It's all within the context of who this company is. And so when you look at the growth stagnant on longer term horizons, certainly falling revenue this year, you look at cash flow not really improving over the past 5 years, and you see that with the exception of a couple months this year, I mean, it's been pretty rangy, if you will, between 45 and 50. And so there hasn't really been a big breakout in this name this year, and that's because growth just isn't there. A lot of that has to do with the demand dynamics of the global economy. If you take a look at their revenue share, it looks like 82% comes to the United States. And so I would expect that given how the United States economy has been moving relative to the other outside, relative to other countries, I would expect better. And so even though the valuation multiples look reasonable, I don't think you should be investing in companies that are just not exhibiting and really have not exhibited much growth over several years. And I think the market agrees with me, short interest, about 7%. A lot of people think this company's going lower. And there's too much debt. Too much debt, too much leverage, not a lot of growth to show for it. Thanks for the call. Now, we got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 minutes or so, and here's some of what we have. Hopefully, we can get to all of it. My main focus point today concerns this topic: exploring fractional real estate, a new investment opportunity. Fractional real estate investing allows multiple investors to own shares of a property, making it accessible without the need to purchase an entire property. This investment method provides opportunities for rental income and property appreciation, with legal agreements outlining investor rights and responsibilities. Could fractional real estate be the key to diversifying your investment portfolio while providing access to high-value properties with lower capital requirements? Also, we'll touch on a new CPI number, what that says about the fight against inflation and the likelihood, and maybe even the magnitude, of a Fed rate cut later this year. We'll also touch on the constant war, another battle between hedge funds and the SEC. Who's winning? What does it mean for the industry as a whole? What does it mean for how well protected you are when you go out in the marketplace? Should we have time at the end of the show, we'll touch on how AI is keeping CEOs up at night. Artificial intelligence, though it hasn't manifested itself in a way that's really helping bottom line profits, is still an important governance concern. So what should managers be thinking about? How should boards be holding them accountable? And what should we as investors be paying attention to? We also have some voice bank questions ready to play, including one on expense ratios and one on DIS, the Walt Disney Company. We also have some questions that came in from our comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel. And of course, we welcome your finance and investment questions now or anytime throughout the show. Now we're headed into a short break. On the other side, we'll talk about today's market activity. And hopefully, we hear from some more of you live. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about H&E Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk,
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk.
With host and financial advisor Justin Klein.
And that volatility. Go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company is falling like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THC.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART. Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk about today's market activity. U.S. stocks mostly higher in an overall uneventful Wednesday, in spite of a CPI print. And they really ended off of best levels, it looks like. And that's really on the heel of maybe a run-up beforehand on Tuesday. We had a big rally on Tuesday, and there was a little bit of a follow-through. The S&P 500 up 38 basis points, NASDAQ flat, Russell 2 down 52 basis points, Dow up 61 basis points. Today's outperformers, PNC Insurance did well, online brokers, foreign banks, investment banks. Underperformers looks like semis, retail and apparel, restaurants, home builders, regional banks didn't do particularly well today. Gold finished down 1.1%, with crude oil ending down at 1.8% as well. And, you know, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, given that the CPI report was in line, it was a quiet session. The report itself generally reconfirming the well-understood disinflationary trend and not likely to shift the Fed rates calculus one way or another in terms of if they are going to cut, but also in terms of the magnitude of the cut. Instead, I think attention is going to be focused this week more on July retail sales tomorrow and what that says about a deteriorating economy, and also what it says about the consumer's ability to continue to spend. Now, digging into that report, and we'll certainly do a little bit more later, CPI came in right in line, as I mentioned, 20 basis points month over month. Of course, CPI also in line with the 20 basis point month over month rise, up to 3.2% year over year versus June's at 3.3%. So still disinflation on the horizon. Shelter prices up 40 basis points month over month after a slower rise in the June report. But like I said, we'll dig into that later. Light day for Fed speak as well. Chicago's Goolsbee saying the Fed needs to cut before labor market weakens further. Certainly that would be the case for maybe even going to 50 basis points instead of 25. Big corporate news as well today. Google down on a report that a breakup is one option being considered by the DOJ following the recent antitrust ruling. So it's going to be interesting to see what they decide to do in terms of follow through on the punishment in the wake of that ruling and what that says about maybe how the FTC should the Democrats still hold the White House at the end of this election. Should the FTC continue to follow through in breaking up some of those large tech companies, or really trying to deal more with antitrust and monopolies in a way that hasn't been done in quite some time? Now, I hope you've been telling your friends and family about our Invest Talk YouTube channel. That's Invest Talk with two T's. And when you go there and you watch, what you'll see is a bunch of charts. You'll see our faces. You'll see this white wall behind me that our producer says I need to spruce up and make it look better as soon as I can. But anyway, it's still a white wall, but the charts are great. And the charts help you follow along and look at some of the data that we're looking at. Now, I'm looking at all these screens. If you could see me, I got like four screens here right now. But one of them is on FactSet, and you can see the beautiful data. And hopefully it'll help you follow along and understand some of our reasoning. But when you go there and you leave a comment with a question, we'd like to get to that. And this question is about IBKR. IBKR. It says, I'm wondering if you have a price target on IBKR, Interactive Brokers. Schwab, Vanguard, and Fidelity are the big players in the industry, but I think they can snatch market share from the big three in the grand scheme of things and would like to keep it for the long haul. So Interactive Brokers is an investment bank, brokerage firm. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't heard of it, but I think the important thing to note here is more so than Fidelity or Schwab, it serves more of a niche client base. And so a lot of their customers are going to be the, let's say, high intensive trading firms, hedge funds, that is not necessarily going to tap into some of the non-institutional trading frameworks that everyday retail does. And so, you know, it's important to note that as opposed to the other brokers, the mix between retail is 55-45, retail and institutional. So it's pretty split towards the institutional client base. And in fact, most of their clients actually still choose to pay commissions when many other retail brokerage firms have switched to zero commission model for the US. And a lot of that is because, like I said, they're trading technology and the maintenance required for that separates them from the rest of the pack in that it is a difficult world to break into because of the complexity of some of their trade execution systems, because of what they're being asked to do. Now, if you know what that might be, then you might hear that as an economic moat. Now let's break down their fundamentals. Over the past 5 years, their revenue's grown on an annualized basis of 26%. 5 year annualized growth rate, 26%, up from 2.3 billion 5 years ago, projected to be 5 billion this year. It was actually 7.8 billion last year. Take a look at their margins. Their margins are improving from 7% net margin to 14% net margin. Their gross margin from 87% to 93%. Now, interestingly enough, that net margin, maybe because of the banking side of business, is a lot lower than I would expect. Or it could just be because of fee compression, but generally speaking, with a lot of investment firms, you see that margin in the 20 to 30%, but I don't think that's a big issue here. I think the reason why IBKR is a good company to look into and maybe even a good company to own is, like I said, they have this niche area of the market that is difficult to break into. It's expensive to break into. And with that being said, it's trading at 3.2 times price to book, five times cash flow. Only 16 times forward-looking earnings, pretty well below the five-year averages. And so, given the difficulty to break in, as I've mentioned, I would not buy this company because you think that it's going to take away from some of the retail side of some of those other companies. I would break into this company because of the area it holds, the moat that it has, the growth that it's had, and the fact that it's still trading at a pretty reasonable price, even with it being up 42% year to date. Now we're headed into a break, and when we come back, we'll speak to Roger from Palo Alto. If you want to talk to us after Roger, feel free to call at 888-99-CHART.
You've got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is ready to provide his unbiased answers. Call now or anytime, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Roger in Palo Alto, who has a question. How can we help you today?
There are two opposing views I'd like your comment on about how long to hold an investment. One is that the correct time is forever. And the other is an observation that most companies will fade or disappear over time.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a good point. I think that generally speaking, when people say hold an investment forever, a good investment forever, that is predicated upon the idea that the reasons why you're holding it, its dominance, its economic moat, its growth, are still the same. Certainly if a company that you bought because it has an expansive ability to reach into a new market, grow, capture market share, it has products that are better than its competitors' products, it is more price competitive than its other competitors as well. If that's still the case, then there's no reason to sell it. Now, that doesn't mean you don't sell any of it. Certainly you can take profit. But holding on to something forever is certainly not the answer. But holding on to something so long as your investment thesis stands, I think, is a better way to think about it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Awesome. Have a wonderful day. Let's go to Bill in Hayward, who has a question about Novo Nordisk. Do you own it? Or are you looking to buy it?
I have a small position in a balanced portfolio. I just wanted to get your take. I was contemplating adding to the position, but just wanted to get your take on what you think a long-term view on Novo on the stock would be.
Yeah, of course. So for those of you who don't know, ticker NVO, Novo Nordisk, is one of the big players in the GLP-1 marketplace. So think of Ozempic, Wegovy. And I think one of the reasons why this company and other companies like this have benefited from these drugs is because when you bring a drug to market, right, you get patents, you get approvals from the FDA, and usually it's a narrow area, right? And it gets approved for severely overweight patients or this diabetes medication just for diabetes or this medication just for heart disease. But what's been happening with GLP-1s is they've actually found that it has been beneficial in more and more use cases. And so that expands your market share, or rather that expands you into different areas of medicine for which it can be prescribed. And if it's effective, it becomes a multi-billion dollar drug. And I think that's one of the things that's happening with this product for Novo Nordisk. Now, that being said, I think the market tends to agree with me as well. It's why it's up almost 30% this year. It's up 50% over the past 52 weeks, and it's currently trading at a price to cash flow 35 times, which is well above its five-year average of 27 times. But I mean, their gross margin stands at around 82.5%. They're very, very efficiently run. Their sales revenue for a massive, massive company, or rather their revenue growth for a massive company, is 13% over the past 5 years. It's doubled, nearly doubled since 2022. And so I think that I don't see any issues with adding more to your position, given that it's not severely overweight. I mean, how much is it in terms of your overall portfolio?
Less than 2%.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I don't see any issues with it with adding to your portfolio here. I would wait for a little bit of a pullback. I mean, it's a very, very strong company at this point. Let me see where it's at. I mean, there's a little dip down to 120. That would have been a nice time to pick it up, but I think it'll probably range between 120, 135 for at least a little bit until there's some sort of market catalyst. People think the rate cut's going to be a market catalyst, but it's kind of priced in at this point. Everyone thinks that that's going to happen, and certainly, if everyone thinks it's going to happen, then not much is going to happen in terms of market performance. So I think there's a little bit there's a lot that's going to prevent the market from breaking out over the next couple months. And so if you see a dip closer to that 120, 125 range, I would look to pick up a little bit more. I think it's a great company. I just think it's a little bit overpriced right now because there's a lot of hype, but for good reason, for good reason. Thanks for the call. Now, my main focus point today is about fractional real estate. And more specifically, purchasing into properties given an aging demographic. So by 2050, the number of Americans aged 65 and older is projected to increase by 47% from 2022 levels. This shift is already starting to reshape the landscape of senior care as more of the population moves into their 70s and 80s. Understandably, the demand for specialized housing, such as assisted living, memory care facilities, is expected to grow significantly. Now, despite this rising need, construction of new senior housing has been pretty slow. Current trends, in fact, show that the second quarter saw the fewest senior housing units under construction since 2014, with construction starts at their lowest levels since 2009. And so this slow pace could potentially lead to a significant gap between supply and demand in the near future. So for real estate investors, this gap represents a substantial opportunity. Properties like Vineyard John Creek Assisted Living Memory Care Facility in Johns Creek, Georgia, highlight how investors can capitalize on this trend. Interestingly, this property and many others like it are being offered at a 20 to 30% discount from its construction cost due to pandemic-related delays and overruns. This presents an even more attractive investment opportunity as the acquisition cost is significantly lower than what the market typically commands. And this is one of many properties with attractive purchase prices across the U.S. Now, while the demographics and potential returns are enticing, investing in senior housing also carries its risks. Investors need to consider factors such as stability of the market, efficiency of the operational model, who the managers are, the overall economic climate affecting disposable income, healthcare costs. Senior housing investments like these not only offer financial returns, but also contribute positively to the economy by addressing critical needs for safe, affordable, appropriate housing for the elderly. The senior living sector represents not just a necessary evolution in real estate, but a strategic investment opportunity that could yield substantial, stable returns. I'm Luke Guerrero. Give me a call.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry, with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development, with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League, and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. oracle.com/bandwidth.
This is InvestTalk, now with 59 million downloads. Tell your friends they can listen live, download the free podcast, or watch InvestTalk on our YouTube channel.
On the next InvestTalk, we'll look into this story, Biden's rent control proposal, what it means for landlords and tenants. President Biden's proposal aims to cap rent increases at 5% for corporate landlords or risk losing federal tax breaks, impacting over 20 million rental units. That's tomorrow, but for now, let's play another listener question.
Hi, I have a question on two stocks, Disney, DIS, and PayPal, PYPL. I hold both of these stocks and I'm around 50% loss. So I just want to know your opinion if you want me to dollar cost average, or hold it for some time, or sell it. I respect your opinion, and it's a great show. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the kind words. And I think probably most people know the situation that Disney is in. Disney is down in a bad way. They started marching back upward, but regardless, they're down 18% over the past 3 months. They've had some pretty significant underperformance since 2021 compared to their industry. 62% underperformed their industry in 2021. And a lot of that is due to the fact that they spent a lot of money on streaming and are just now starting to turn a profit. And so I'm just going to answer one question because it's, you know, we want to get to everybody's question, and analyzing two stocks and looking at that can be a little time consuming. So we'll just take a look at Disney. And I think one of the benefits that Disney has is certainly its IP. It is one of the most well-known brands on the face of the earth. And frankly, the mouse is priceless. I think that they had a CEO in between when Bob Iger was CEO, so he didn't run the company as well. They had a proxy fight with Nelson Peltz that was certainly distracting. And it seems that over the past year or so, the company has started to do better in terms of actually making money on its streaming. I hope that they stop throwing money at certain IP, looking at the Marvel movies here, and start to focus more on their core business. But I also like their potential venture into live sports. And so I think from a growth perspective over the next 5 years, with the backbone of the business being it's honestly anybody else would kill to have at IP, I think the growth is there. It's just a ship that had to be righted. Streaming is improving. Sports is on the horizon. I think personally, maybe right now not being the best time to pick it up. Let me take a look at it from a technical perspective real quick. And even if I wouldn't pick it up now, it's still on my watch list. It's on my watch list personally for one of our strategies. It's on our firm's watch list for one of our strategies, and that's because of the what it holds. But I mean, it broke down past its support of 90. It could head lower down to 80. It could even break that, but I would take a look and see if it finds some more support around 80 and look to pick some up there. I don't think this is a situation where this is a company that is, you know, headed on a downward spiral. They don't have debt issues. It's a $50 billion of debt on a $155 billion market cap company. They have the business. They have the growth avenues. It's just about riding the ship. Their cash flow is improving. Their profitability is looking better. I think it's on the mend. I'm keeping it on my watch list. I think you should keep it on yours too. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Robert in Pleasanton, who has a question about Nike. Do you own it? Are you looking to buy it?
I'm thinking about buying it, and, you know, much like Disney, I know it's taken a big hit. Looks like maybe it's starting to draw some interest from some big investors, and just wondering if you think this is a time to jump into it.
Yeah, of course. Let's take a look. So Nike is a over $100 billion company. Just like Disney, they don't have much debt on their balance sheet. They only have about $12 billion. They're not overly leveraged at all. Their cash flow has kind of been all over the place for the past 5 years. But really what's hurt them is forward-looking guidance and poor earnings over the past year or so. And a lot of that is the result of deteriorating consumer spending. You see it not just in companies like Nike. You see it in Starbucks. It was another big business that was doing poorly because of their customer base pinching pennies and not spending as much money. You see it with Lululemon. That I don't think Lululemon is in the same category here. I think Lululemon serves a niche market and their moat was eroding with a bunch of other brands. Whereas Nike is a global force that more importantly is tied to various sports franchises and sports leagues. And their brand is out there. Their brand is so much more than the shorts and shoes they sell. It is so entwined within culture, within not just the United States, but sports globally, that again, this is like I said about Disney and like you said as well, this is a business that has a brand that took decades to be built and is so intertwined within society that when you have a situation where the company is not spiraling because there's a mismanagement of their balance sheet, right? They have plenty of room. This is a pure earnings story and a pure growth story. They've been buying back shares over the past couple of years. They pay a pretty consistent dividend. Even with the pullback, their margins are still sitting around 10% for this year. And so when we take a look at their chart, I mean, they dropped back in, you know, after earnings most recently at the end of June. It looks like they're consolidating 70 to 80. You know, I think a lot for me, I would take note of what happens with retail sales tomorrow. I think there's been some worry about deteriorating consumer spending power in the wake of a tightening job market. Loosening job market. And so before I start to take a position in here and before I think it's going to start to recover in a substantial way, you're going to have to see some proof that the economy is not as hurt as maybe recent jobs data suggested it is. So I'm going to keep a keen focus on retail sales tomorrow and what that says going forward. I think you should as well. Thanks for the call. Speaking of economic data, let's turn to the cooler than expected topic of inflation and unpack the latest data on the CPI. So in July, the consumer price index rose by 2.9% year over year, slightly below the expectation of 3%. Even more telling, core prices, which strip out the volatile food and energy sectors, saw a 3.2% increase over the past year and a modest 20 basis point rise since June. These figures are important as they mark a continuation of a disinflation trend, with core prices increasing by 20 basis points or less monthly for three consecutive months. Now, taken within the context of other economic data, this should bolster the Federal Reserve's confidence to begin easing monetary policy. After months of speculation and anticipation, it seems increasingly likely the Fed will cut interest rates at its next meeting in September. Yet despite these positive signs, not all news is reassuring. Because when you dig deeper into the report, which you always should, in this instance, you see the cost of housing continues to rise at an accelerating pace. And so there's potential challenges there. Now, it's also important to note that when thinking about the path of monetary policy, the macro environment is deteriorating slightly, but not really aggressively. Certainly, I don't think it warranted some of the reaction that we saw last week. In spite of that recent jobs report, which showed an unexpected uptick in unemployment, many economists remain optimistic that the U.S. economy can stave off a near-term recession, and certainly if there was one, that it wouldn't be that deep. I've made the point that the recent jobs market cooling, a lot of it was due to temporary layoffs, hurricane-related temporary layoffs. That's why it's important to dig deeper into the numbers and why this month is going to be important as well. Solid household spending figures also do provide some reassurance about the underlying strength of the consumer sector, which is why I said it's important to look at retail sales tomorrow. Most importantly, in recent months, the PCE, which is the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, shows a downward trend from a high of 7.1% 2 years ago to 2.5% in June. So if this trend holds through the end of August, I don't think the Fed needs any more reasons. And that then can refocus the debate, not if the Fed will cut rates, but by how much. Now, some are betting on a more aggressive half percentage point cut. It's speculation fueled by comments from officials, including Tom Barkin from the Richmond Fed, who recently discussed the need to assess whether the economy is simply normalizing or if more decisive action is needed. But short of any further deterioration or a solidifying weak job market, I think for that this Fed, who's been sometimes overly cautious, the more likely scenario is one that does not move too fast, does not move too forcefully, but certainly moves in the direction of easing rates. Now, here's another question that came into our InvestTalk YouTube channel. This one on NXT. It says, do you have any thoughts on Australian data center company NXT? So NXT is, as I just said, an Australian data center company. I think most of its revenue comes directly from Australia. Give me one moment here. Sometimes it's difficult to pull these things up. Yeah, so most of its revenue comes from Australia. In fact, 99% of its revenue comes from Australia. So that is the definition of most, if not all. And I think one of the things that's benefited this company, which is a data center company, is the growth in cloud adoption. And so that's really supported this continued evolution of the telecommunications market, the continued evolution of data storage. And what has been driving this is their growth, their sales growth, 20% over the past 5 years, from 152 million AUD, Aussie dollar, to 410 million Aussie dollar. And that's from both public and private investors. And so when you have a business model like this that is growing, when you have a business model like this that is growing, that's great, right? You can, it trades at a, I would say, a discount to some of its peers in terms of its growth. But the issue for me with this company is an issue that I think Justin agrees with. It's an issue that Steve had with companies as well. And that's don't buy companies that don't make money. Of the past 5 years, past 6 years, it's only made money two of those years. So until they can consistently turn a profit, regardless of how their revenue has been growing, until they can consistently turn a profit, because there is some execution risk in terms of their growth strategy, until they can consistently turn a profit, I would have to pass. Thanks for watching. Let's fit in one more question before we head to the break. This one from Philadelphia.
Hey, Luke, Bill from Philadelphia. Question about expense ratios for products such as ETFs. How do they work? is basically the question. Is it like a one-time fee? Do you say it's a 10 basis point expense ratio? Is that charged by, say, a Vanguard yearly, monthly, when you first buy, when you sell? Because if you hold it for long term, I would imagine they charge the expense ratio one time annually and so forth. Just wanted to get some clarification on that to know exactly what I'm paying. Thanks for what you guys do, and I appreciate you guys.
So the question is about how expense ratios work in funds, and it's a little complicated, so I'll try and explain it as simplistically as possible. And so when you have a mutual fund or you have an ETF, your purchase price is what's called a NAV, a net asset value. And legally speaking, the net asset value is supposed to be a fair value representation of the assets of the fund. And so when you see a dollar price, that is a per share representation of the asset value of the fund. Now, the NAV that you see isn't exactly the value of the assets in the fund. And that's not just because sometimes you make fair value adjustments because certain markets are closed, whatever. The reason why is because on a daily basis, daily, fund expenses are accrued. So when you see that 10 basis points expense ratio, you take that 10 basis points, you split it out over every day of the year, and daily, based on the total value of the fund, you get what's called an accrued fee. And so you don't see the accrued fees. You never actually view yourself paying these accrued fees. But think of it as like the accrued fees going into a separate just book account that the money doesn't really go anywhere, but it doesn't link to your NAV anymore. And so on a daily basis, as the days go on, that net asset value that you see on the market is being reduced daily by the expense ratio. And so all of the cash, all of the assets are still in the fund until they're generally, I think it depends, sometimes taken out quarterly, sometimes taken out annually. But all the assets are still there, but it's as if they're not there for you. And that's why the value adjusts when you look at it at the daily price of the fund. And so to answer your question, expenses accrue daily. You won't see them really on these ETFs when you buy or sell them. And that's because the adjustment is already made for you. It's already in that cost. It's not something that'll come out of it. It's not something extra. Hope that adds some clarity. Thanks for the call. Now, there seems to be a constant struggle between the financial services industry and the SEC, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, specifically hedge funds and private equity firms. Now, in early 2022, Citadel's chief legal officer, Sean Fagan, reached out to Eugene Scalia, a prominent lawyer known for taking on U.S. regulators. They discussed a response to the SEC's aggressive new rules proposed under Chair Gary Gensler, and these rules aim to increase oversight of what's often referred to as the shadow banking sector, which includes private equity firms and hedge funds. Now, the strategy went beyond mere opposition to specific aspects of the SEC rules. Instead, it involved challenging the SEC's very authority to impose regulations at all. Now, this move is part of a broader legal push against federal regulatory powers, influencing not just the financial sector, but potentially setting precedent that could affect regulatory scope across various industries. Now, to increase their chances of a favorable ruling, the industry group didn't go to Washington, where such cases are typically argued. Instead, they chose the conservative-leaning Fifth Circuit, and the decision paid off when, in June, the court sided with them. This legal victory has significant implications. Not only challenges the SEC's rules on private funds, which require greater transparency from firms, but it also questions the broader ability of federal agencies to enforce regulations at all. Now, as this legal drama unfolds, the financial markets and regulatory landscape continue to evolve. Stakeholders from across the spectrum, from hedge funds to retail investors, need to watch closely as the outcomes of these legal battles could reshape how regulations are crafted and enforced, which in turn influences everything from market dynamics to the protections of you and me. Now, this is Invest Talk, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here: to help you achieve your financial freedom.
The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. So don't forget to call Invest Talk, 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Stephen, Justin. This is Paolo from Germany calling. I'm looking at a stock, Mueller Industries. I've been onto them since many months. And when is there like a good time to buy this stock? Like, or what would be a good entry point right now? Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
So Mueller Industries, what they do is they manufacture copper, brass, and aluminum products, piping. Primarily their piping system, 70% of the revenue. They have some climate system, 14% of the revenue as well. But their primary metal that they use is copper. Now, they've had a stock repurchase program over the past 5 years, which certainly we like. But most importantly, this company has benefited a lot from falling copper prices. And so profitability looks pretty darn good. Net margins at 18%. Almost 18% last year, up from 5% in 2020. And those margins really started to increase in 2021, 2022, last year as well. They have no debt, really, $36 million on a $7.6 billion market cap company. Their cash flow has been improving over the past 3 years. Now, you ask when it was a good time to buy this company, and the answer is, well, probably in May, when it was trading at $55 a share, probably before the price of copper started to fall precipitously. And so the reason why this company is doing so well is because their margins have expanded because their input costs are lower. Now, their growth prospects are kind of drying up a little bit. It has a consensus hold rating right now, even though its price to earnings is only 13 times. Its price to cash flow is 12 times right now, which is well above its five-year average. But I think if you believe that copper specifically, then certainly they could shift more towards brass and aluminum. But if copper specifically is going to be in the medium term in more demand because of green technologies and more demand because of an economy that's picking up globally, that's not going to be good for this company because that's one of their biggest input costs. So I think it's probably a little expensive. Certainly the growth has been decent with the exception of the past 2 years. I mean, the revenue has been flat. The reason why they're doing better is because their margins have expanded. Their gross margin expanded from 14 to 28%, like a double. So for me, I'd have to pass. I think the medium-term dynamics are probably going to move against this as their costs start to increase. Thanks for the call. Now, before we head off, I want to talk a little bit about artificial intelligence, and more specifically, how in the rapidly evolving landscape of corporate governance, the integration and regulation of artificial intelligence is becoming really a central theme in boardrooms across the U.S. At a recent bank board meeting, directors experienced firsthand the power of AI when they listened to what they thought was their chief executive discussing strategy. Turns out, it was a voice cloning model trained on the CEO's prior speeches. Creepy. Now, this exercise wasn't just a technical demonstration, but a crucial learning experience aimed at understanding the profound impacts, but also the potential risks of generative technologies. As AI becomes more sophisticated, its deployment in corporate settings is increasing, but so is the complexity of its implications. And that gives boards a dual challenge. Not only do they have to grasp how AI can drive business growth and efficiencies, they also have to oversee the risks associated with AI, data security, privacy, and the potential for generating inaccurate or intentionally misleading information. And so this legal landscape must also be a significant concern for the board. With AI's ability to replicate human behavior and even decisions, boards are under pressure to ensure their companies comply with emerging regulations while also safeguarding against ethical breaches. So what are some boards doing? Well, they're engaging with AI experts, incorporating AI risk assessments into their governance frameworks, and even participating in specialized training sessions offered by leading business schools. The integration of AI into corporate governance it's not just about technology adoption. It's about fundamentally rethinking how businesses operate and how they're regulated. As AI continues to reshape industries, board members must stay informed and agile, ready to adapt to new challenges and opportunities that AI presents. But this also means that us, as investors, we must also be cognizant and choose firms that are proactive rather than reactive on the new frontier. I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another episode of Invest Talk. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. You can get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify, and please be sure to leave us a rate and review. You can also go to our Invest Talk YouTube channel, that's Invest Talk with two T's, and check out our videos. I like them. Hopefully you do too. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.